Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Okay, welcome to another edition of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have the big man himself. I mean, I'm a small dude, but never do I feel as small as I do when I stand beside Devon Toner.
Did you bring in a couple of milk crates and stand on the pitch, I think?
I stood beside him one day in the restaurant for a whole day, and I was like, look, I don't want to see you for a long time. I felt like a wee five-year-old out of place in the kitchen. Devon's really into his food. Looking forward to having him in, seeing what he's been up to since retirement. I haven't seen him in the media or talking to anyone. When I worked with him last year, he was getting ready for said retirement. He's married to a phenomenal chef, actually, Mary. She was in Chapter 1 when I met her first.
Well.
Yeah, so be interested to see who does the pots and pans in their house.
And I think it's always great to talk to anyone that was in the world of professional sport.
Yeah.
How different their life is now.
Yeah, is he digging into the minstrels now that he's that he's not training for a living? And as always, we will have our ingredient, fresh ingredient of the week. We'll be answering all your questions. Food at goloudnow.com. If you don't know it, food at goloudnow.com. Get them in. We love putting them all together and answering as many as we can. Okay, so it is ingredient of the week, guys. You go first. What are you bringing to the table?
I'm gonna go with pork ribs, and the reason I'm going with them, like I love pork, any cut of it. I love the belly.
I know. I have to think of a different one. Go ahead.
But pork is an ingredient that it's probably the most amount of skill required, I think, when you're going to cook pork, because it's so easy to get it dry, it's so easy to overcook it. So pork ribs are a big, we spoke about chicken wings last week and much we love them, so pork ribs is one that I love, and I think it's a cheaper cut of ingredient. It's a real Saturday at home. We spoke about the barbecue last week. Someone threw in a question about they were just venturing into the world of barbecuing. So anything where there's meat touching onto the bone is where you're going to get a lot of flavour. So I shared a recipe quite recently of how to do pork ribs on my socials there if you want to go and have a look. But I just think you don't have to spend loads of money. You get loads of flavour back in return. And it's probably one that people don't always look to go.
I do a barbecue pork rib for a week. Cora, Annette doesn't like eating them, you know what I mean? She doesn't like chicken wings or pork ribs. It's weird, you know, and she loves food, but just
not into them
at all, you know what I mean? But I put a lot of work into, I saw your recipe on there, actually not a million miles off mine, only I do them in a wet braise.
Okay, yeah.
Pretty much nearly all the flavors were the same. Yours is a far quicker way of doing it than my one, you know. And the only difference is I have an element of orange juice, 7-Up in the liquor along with barbecue maple.
7-Up?
Yeah, just for sweetness.
Right,
yeah,
cool.
And a cooking medium. And then that cooking liquor is what I cook down for then the glazing phase. But again, you'd have to go back further on my Instagram, but you'll see them up there. But I do, it's a day's... I whenever I've got a bit of time, usually it's around now actually when it's playoff season in the NFL, I kind of transport my home in Longford to Boston, and I love cooking those things that I associate with NFL games and wings.
I think this time of year in January, I tend to do those kind of slow roasty, lazy type of things. And I made them, the ribs I made, just some celeriac coleslaw and some baked potatoes. Perfect. Just so delicious. And as I said, you don't have to spend loads of money, but... you know, it's handy if you know how to do it, but it's I just think it's the pork in general is something that all chefs, I think, like, because there's so much flavor.
You hit the nail on the head there, though. Like, it is so lean that it's something that's got to be.
You have to know what to do.
You got to really know what you're doing. Your timing is of the essence when it comes to. I mean, it goes from being good, perfect, to ruined very quickly. Yeah. It's almost like a piece of fish in a way.
Yeah.
You know, where I always say, like, the perfect fish dish is 10 seconds away from a disaster, you know?
Okay, very good. And what are you going with this week?
I'm going to go with tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Now, we're obviously a few months away from the Irish tomato season, which is, of course, one of the shortest lived seasons of anything that you can grow in Ireland, obviously for climate reasons. very, very beautiful ingredient. I mean, depending where you get them, like I used to buy these Mirinda tomatoes from my wee Italian brother, Mario, that I know you know Mario quite well as well.
But friend of mine.
Yeah, you could spend any kind of money, hey, on really good heirloom tomatoes, you know what I mean? A Caprese salad with crusty bread, Villa Monodori, balsamic, at Fincas Tres Fuentes, olive oil. I wish I was wearing a jacket that just said Villa Monodori on the back, like Del Piero, and I could have it at the ready anytime I wanted it. But again, a ripe tomato. I always remember walking down through Boston Common, right? There was a boy out in a wee, I wouldn't even say a food truck, it was a food cart, right? And he had a chopping board, all these tomatoes. Now, there was also avocados there, right? At a time when an avocado wasn't really, I don't think I ever saw one in Ireland, right? And I went over and I goes, "What's going on here, sir?" And he says, "Oh, I'm just selling tomatoes. He just gives you a bit of kitchen roll, cores the tomato, splits it, cuts it, whatever way you want to cut, sliced, diced, whatever, into a wee container or straight onto the piece of kitchen. Then he seasons it with flaked Maldon or whatever it was, and you pay him whatever it was, $1 a tomato or $1, whatever, I can't remember that. But I went and I got a phone card because at the time there was no cell phones or I didn't have one. I wasn't in Boston long. I went into the Omni Parker House Hotel off of Boston Common. I rang Mammy and said, "The shit you've made me eat all my life." Do you know, if the old dog got a tomato, right, and she couldn't put a knife through it, so generally half of it was kind of green, right? You know, I used to get tomato sandwiches, a salty tomato sandwich going to school or whatever.
Your so, I give you tomato sandwiches.
Sometimes, yeah, and you take out a tomato sandwich at 12:30 after being in a lunchbox. You can imagine, it's like eating a fucking sponge, right? And I used to say there, I was like going, how am I cooking at the level I'm cooking at after the shit you made me eat for the last 20 odd years? Do you know what I mean? And she'd just be like, "It didn't kill you, sir. It didn't kill you." You know what I mean? But I ate the tomato this day in Boston Common and it blew my mind. I was just like, how can it be so good? And then
sunshine, my friend.
I started, well, of course. And then, you know, you start becoming older and you're becoming a better chef and you're working with better and better places and so on and so forth. And then you start getting to the point where you're in charge of purchasing and you're the one doing whatever, and you really, really start to appreciate the bare, bare bones. Not that I never did, but, you know, it's not just about appreciating the lobster or an oyster or a beef or a filet or whatever it may be, that where are these onions coming from? Where are these scallions coming from? The herbs, the bread, and these tomatoes. And I always go back to Boston Common. But look, for me, you know, whether it's in a soup via minestrone or a tomato basil soup or it's a ragu, like I love using fresh tomatoes even. It's one of the few things that I would say when you buy in a tin, because they're cooked and blanched and whatever and canned at their finest. That's an art that's been mastered by the Spanish and the Italians for generations. They can be so good, which is brilliant actually, because it allows us to have nice bolognese's, nice ragouts all through the winter, because they're obviously canned at their peak and so on. They're laid out on tables across continental Europe to dry in the sun, and semi-dried tomatoes and sun-dried tomatoes. They're just so versatile, and I, for one, love them.
Yeah,
simply.
Same. And, you know, last week you spoke about, you know, memories from a childhood of a chicken. Aye. But like, I have memories of being on holidays as a kid when we were in Spain or whatever, yeah. We were on holidays. And I wasn't crazy on tomatoes growing up, but when I was on holidays, they just taste the difference. And I never knew why.
Look at, I mean, you, Billy Big Balls. I never got further than Creasland whenever I was going on holidays.
Yeah, that's because you keep slagging your mom about what she was giving you. I wouldn't bring you anywhere either.
Jesus Christ. I only got there a restaurant when we confirmation.
You see, that's what
communion.
Happens when you're the second youngest of seven.
And you a dirty Northsider as well, going to Spain. I'm Carmelinos.
I just said, exactly. Santa Ponsa in the sun. That's exactly what used to happen. But yeah, but I just remember. And look, my dad is from the world of catering. So
is he?
Yeah, my dad worked on B&I and Irish Ferries. And
you didn't lick it off a stone then, huh?
No, my mum worked in a hotel. So food and catering has always been a big part of our lives. And my dad, actually, when he retired, went to Cattle Brewer Street and done the chef's course. Wow. After he retired. Yeah.
He was a bit late.
He was a bit late, but he just has the love of food. And yeah.
So what did he do in hotels? Was he a chef or no?
Well, no, he was a waiter.
He just wanted to do it.
Yeah, he worked in the Intercon when he served his time in the Intercon. Back then, there was a 5-year apprenticeship to be a waiter. So you learned to...
Class. Jesus, the things you learn, boys. Mm. That's brilliant.
Yeah, so he's... But food and also food experiences were... I remember, like...
Well, it's great that you can tap into them for the
marker. But I remember having crepe Suzette's on Pancake Tuesday.
Here.
But the reason being is because my dad was...
He was doing them table
side. Well, he was classically trained in proper table side cookery.
So I mean, you're eating fucking fish and chips with a tub of curry last week.
and now you're eating
crepe Suzette, would you stop?
Exactly. Well, you know.
I can't keep up with you, man. I just can't keep up.
There you go.
Evil scenes.
Yeah, deadly.
Okay, so... a man most of our listeners are going to be familiar with has joined us here. Devon Toner, welcome to Dishing It Out.
Thanks for having me, Les. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think, well, it didn't surprise me because, I mean, I met you sort of different times over the years and know that you're married to a fantastic chef yourself, but you probably shocked a lot of the country when they saw your love and interest in food when you're on the restaurant. Was it last year, the year before?
It was last year, last year. And it was actually, just so happens, it was on a rerun last night.
I got a
text from some of the family saying, oh, we're on again tonight. And I was like,
oh, deadly.
Yeah, so it was on.
I always say I wish I had a residual pay structure there that every time it was shown I get a wee royalty check in the post. Oyster's Rockefeller definitely was on there.
A lemon tart, didn't you?
The lemon tart was
I can't
on
believe
well.
You done a lemon tart for
Marco Pierre White. He's famous for his
that's what I heard when I brought it in. I was like
if you work in air game, right, you will have definitely you would have definitely made Marco's
lemon
really
tart.
He's world famous for it.
Yeah,
he's really famous for not getting the pastry soggy. That's his whole thing.
Oh, really?
Like it was the pastry crisp.
You want to see him?
It ended up, I think we had one or two that wasn't, though. Then we were like,
We just chuck him out.
Yeah, wrapped him on the fly.
Yeah, panzanella, wasn't there a tomato?
Panzanella salad, because
I nailed that. I got to take a lot of credit for this.
Well, the bread was the main part, which I brought in with me.
Dev, is it a starter? Well, yeah.
Well, I'm going to say that's what I got into over COVID. No, as in everyone did, just sourdough, and I loved it, absolutely loved it.
How did you find that process of learning about it?
I just tried it online, and I got...
You made a start yourself?
I didn't make the start of myself. I got it from Reg White, Reggie Does Pizza. So
he gave
me a bit of start, and then kind of got into it then. And
did you get it from the start, or was it a process of making a mess of it a lot of times?
I made a mess of it a few times, but then it kind of got better and better. Like I did.
His bread was unbelievable, by the way. It was class.
No, but like it's just great for that kind of salad as well. You know what I mean? So like it was.
Have you made it since?
I've neglected my mother. I think my mother is dead in my fridge, to be honest.
She's in there, but she's not breathing.
Exactly. When you're back to work and you're back into the normal world, it's kind of hard to keep to,
well, that's
to
the
do.
Problem with sourdough.
Just because the process of sourdough, if you want to bake it on Saturday morning, you have to start it on Thursday. Do you know what I mean? You have to get out and feed it and all this stuff. Yeah. And then you need a good 4 hours where you have to like turn it and then go back to it in half an hour, turn it. You need 4 hours and then you need to shape it and then put it in the fridge. It's you need to plan for about be at home for 3 days to get to do it.
Over lockdown, I wouldn't have had great bread skills. I can make all the normal yeasty breads and all that. And I was like, I'll start doing a bit of sourdough. And I was talking to Kieran Glennon all the time. Kieran is the head chef at Gibo's, and he was walking me through it, and he's very competitive bloke, Kieran is, but like every morning he was like, did you bake it yet? Send it on. I'm supposed to be off here, and I really feel like he's managing me, but I got the hang of it then, and it's addictive when you see it starting to happen.
Sorry, I just remembered how I actually got into it. We did a course Mary bought me a course for Inchscale Bakery.
Okay.
They used to do things, so I started out doing there, and then
did you use the Dutch oven? Is that where you were cooking it?
And then I bought the whole cast iron one where you
So you really got into it. Cast iron pot.
And you use that? Yeah.
I have the pizza oven at home, but I haven't done it in the pizza oven yet. But
Which type of pizza oven?
So I've the Gosney dome.
Oh, you bought the dome?
Yeah.
How was it?
Love it. Absolutely. It's class. Yeah, love it.
Thinking about pulling the trigger on
it's dual fuel.
Oh my, I haven't bought one. No.
It's the gas and the wood.
You were renovating your outdoor kitchen when I saw
got
you
it done.
Last.
Yeah.
It's all boxed off.
All done now. Yeah, all done. Love it. So I've got the Gosney dome and I've got a nice beef eater built in barbecue, cool. Which is nice.
So that Gosney now, I know we're getting a wee bit techie here, but is it gas powered or is
Boiling
it
fuel. Both?
It's gas and wood.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so you can do both.
You have pellets, is that the wood you're using? Or can you actually load wood into it?
Just load wood into it. Yeah, I don't use a pellet. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
deadly.
I've only done the wood once or twice, but usually it's just the gas. You slip.
Gosney, do the right thing, Gary and Gareth at the Marconi House, Dublin something. Figure it out. Send two.
It was a shout,
lads. Yeah.
Tag Tom Gosney.
Yeah. No, I never knew that there was such a thing as a dual one then or whatever. Yeah.
Oh no, I've researched it up and down.
Must go creeping on your Instagram then, Dev.
So where did the world of food start? Have you fond memories from growing up? Or?
Yeah, like, do you know what? We're a kind of a big foodie family, I suppose. My mom was class, you know, she still is. She's brilliant. And then kind of we all got into it. My sister, she actually runs a grazing table food company now. So she's a wildflower grazing. So she does grazing tables. So she was always big into it as well.
Well.
My brother Dara is big into barbecue and all the meats as well. So we're kind of, as a family and brothers and sisters, we were all into dinner parties. Yeah. Although my sister and my brother, they're fed up with cheese and crackers now. Because there's always the leftover boxes and you're always kind of great. Yeah. And so they're kind of fed up with it at the minute. But then it just kind of evolved over time. And then Gary knows my wife Mary. She was big into cooking as well. She was she did a stint in Chapter One as a patron. She did the Ballymanoo cookery course, the 3 month course. And then through that she got into Chapter One for 6 months doing pastry kind of thing. And then after that, with Darren,
yeah.
And then she started going down the cake route, so doing custom cakes, do you mean, for birthdays and stuff, and then kind of started a website called Bakers and Cakers. It was kind of a two-sided marketplace for connecting people with cakers. She's not making themselves. And then I think eventually it didn't come out very viable. Like there's not a lot of cash involved. Like
yeah. It is, but yeah, I would have met Mary when I did a show Head Chef with Conor Gallagher years ago. Yeah, Mary made the final of that, you know, and I kind of done a few. I did a masterclass episode with Stefan, who was at Ashford Castle at the time, and got to know Mary. And then the first time I met you was at the final dinner, I think, because we were in the Westin, I think, for the dinner. And yeah, so very talented. Yeah,
and when did the rugby? So like you're playing rugby from.
Yeah,
4 or 5. Like, did you get into it from the start? Or?
Started it about maybe when it was 7 or 8 in Norcalair, and then went to school in Castleknock. So then we played in Castleknock College up in 6 year, and then from that got Leinster Schools, Ireland Schools. Then you get into the academy. So I went into the academy after school, and then kind of progressed all the way up. So I've been at it my entire life, really.
What age do you get a pro contract? And is it depending on how good you are, or like once you're in the academy, is it pretty much a guarantee that you're?
Nowadays if you get into the academy, you usually maybe do 1 year sub academy, so it's not actual contract, and then you might get into the academy, and then I think nowadays you do have to spend 3 years in the academy, and then you might get offered a pro contract. Back when I was coming out, I think if they saw you early enough, you'd be lucky enough to get out. So I did 1 year sub academy, I did 1 year academy, and then I got a development contract, which is the senior squad. So I got a development contract when I was 20 maybe. So I got into senior squad then.
And could you see the approach change in nutrition from when like you were coming out of school into getting into the professional game, or was that ever a big thing for you? Or?
No, you could see it was getting more professional the older I got, basically. Tail end of my career, not the tail end of my career, sorry, the middle of my career, we had a nutritionist coming in called Daniel Davey. He's a Davey nutrition. He did really good stuff. And then we kind of kicked on from there.
Did you have any time with Morris in the chef that joined you?
Yes, phenomenal.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Donegal man. He was a year behind me at college. But he's really into it, you know.
He was only there my kind of last year of the squad.
I was going to say.
But I was picking his brains. I was going into the kitchen to see the broth he was using. using for his soups because he did a French onion soup that was unbelievable.
Unreal, yeah, yeah.
And he put so much passion and effort. Like literally, the lads love going into camp.
Yeah,
but it makes a big difference, I'd say, for the morale and everything. 100%. The field is right.
100%.
Oh yeah. I mean, you could see, like, because obviously, Morris and I follow each other, like, and we know each other for years, like, and. And since that new place, I mean, you used to stay at Carrington House, you all stay. Yep. What's it called now?
It's the high performance
unit.
Near Black.
And so then they obviously hired a chef as well. But then when he just went down to New Zealand 2 years ago, whenever it was, I saw that he went with you. And obviously he was based in France all summer. And I mean, that really, I mean, if you followed the chef's career, I suppose, you just by default you're following the Irish rugby professionalism that they've now gone from, I suppose, just whatever the nutritionist tells the chef in New Zealand or France, whereas now travelling actually with the own culinary team, like, it must make a massive difference that you all know what you're going to eat, you trust who's going to be cooking it, and it probably comes out on the field as well. I mean, it certainly looks that way
100%
from the outside.
It just gives a good environment to be in as well. If you know the stuff you're going to be getting is top quality, it just adds into it.
You should probably all in there asking them for your favourites, are you?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah.
The All Blacks stayed with us a few years ago, and they have have these date scones after. I think it must be the day before the match, so it's their big carb load day.
Right.
And the nutrition was on to me months before. Can you get dates in Ireland? I was asking. And I was like, what? And I was like, you're being serious. He meant, you've no idea how seriously these lads take these date scones. He was like, we got caught. They were somewhere and he couldn't get dates and they were all like pissed off at him.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, man, of course I can get played in dates. Like, yeah, don't stress over it. So we made these date scones and now you can imagine the calories. Like one scones, loads of butter, loads of buttermilk and then all these dates. Yeah. And these lads were eating two or three of these scones and lashing loads more butter
and
cream and jam.
Because they were getting the calories in.
I know,
But they were going across to Scotland then, and the chef for nutrition said to me, they're saying that they're the best scones that they've had since they've left New Zealand. Will you make more for them? And I made them and froze them and they brought them over to Scotland. But it was out of all the sports teams that I've looked after, I found the rugby approach the most fascinating, because some of the lads just had to eat so many calories because they're so big.
Yeah.
You know, and where with football teams and women's football teams in particular, I've looked after a couple of the professional women, they're so strict with how they're eating because they're trying to keep their calories down and their carbs down at times.
What about you? Do you find that hard? Do you get away with whatever you want? Or
no.
Did you not?
No,
but,
you had to be careful, did you?
The thing that you had to be
wary of. Just no pints.
The thing that you had to be wary of was when you were going into Ireland camp of getting camp belly. That was what we call it. Like, you'd literally put on about 5 kilos.
Obviously. Really?
Yeah, 100%. Jesus. And then when you come back out and you go back to Leinster, it's back to yourself, like, so you have to try and get it off.
Right.
But, like, you'd have to be getting, like, we call them DEXA scans. You get the whole body scan of
body fat or
percentage and everything. So you're always constantly looked at, but, like, oh, geez, I could put on weight when looking at something, you know?
Yeah.
But, and not good weight. Do you know what I mean? So some lads can put on muscle or whatever, like, and I think when some lads retire, you either go one of two ways. You either go heavy or you go light.
Right.
And I went the heavier option.
Yeah, because we had Greg O'Shea in here a few weeks ago, and when he was playing for the Sevens, he was talking about he just doesn't eat.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, but when he did dial into his nutrition, how much better he got.
He had no engine, yeah.
Yeah, because he was just running out of juice because he wasn't eating enough, you know, and he was like, when you actually learn then how to feed yourself correctly.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting now with kids coming up, like 14, 15, 16. Well, I have a 16-year-old, so, and he's mad into training, you know. He plays soccer, but I mean, obviously, he has me at home, so I'm trying to tell him how important that getting your food right is.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast,
giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud sounds better with us.
And have you had to like get strict about the training, or have you just down tools? Or I mean, you look good.
I have a lot of places to hide it.
Yeah.
I haven't trained at all. And I've said to myself, right,
trained at all.
January, I'm going to do something, and it's the 29th of January. I still haven't done anything.
Yeah.
But no, I do have to get back on track because
saying the 14-minute walk to work is killing you. Yeah, we were slagging it off air earlier.
It's tough on the car. It's tough.
You miss being around the team.
Yeah, that's the, one of the biggest questions you get when you finish off, do you miss it? And like the year after I started finished playing, I was like, I don't miss it at all. Yeah. I did it for so long.
That's good though. That's a good place to be. You know?
But what you do miss is the environment. You miss the lads. You miss the crack. You miss seeing everyone every day. It's going in and seeing going to work with your friends.
What did a Monday to Friday look like at Leinster? Like was it every day training Monday to Friday or
so? If the game was on Saturday, you'd come in on Monday, and then you would have obviously played on that weekend as well. Yeah. So you come in and you do your video review. So you go in at say 8 o'clock in the morning,
right?
Do your reviews, do your videos, and then you do kind of a weight session in the morning, and then a break, and then a pitch session in the afternoon.
Right.
Tuesday, same again, in at 8, videos, meetings, weights, pitch session, and then down tools, and then Wednesday off.
Right.
Back in Thursday, light weights, light pitch. Friday back in, just a captain's run. So it's just you just run through the plays and then Saturday play.
Right.
Yeah. So it's
Wednesday was the magic day then. Yeah.
I'm about a day up. You do nothing then. You just go and rest.
Yeah. So my last couple of years, they were kind of billing that as the personal development day.
Right.
So they would give it to you as in you need to do something. Don't come in. Don't focus on rugby. Go and do something college course. Do something that will develop you off the pitch, basically.
And then what did you do there? And did you follow their advice, sir?
My final year, because I'm in kind of the financial services sector now, I knew where I was going. I knew what direction I was going in. So I started studying for the QFAs, so the qualified financial advisor. So I did my QFA exams over in my last year.
Well, that's good, isn't it? That they're bringing that like kind of progression into the world of sport.
Mm. You've probably seen a massive. How many years did you play at Leinster?
About 17 years, yeah.
You saw some difference, I'd say, from year one to year 17.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, when did that, I suppose, professionalism kick in, like, proper, like 5 or 6 years in? Because it seems to be, you seem to be at the elite level for a long time.
Yeah, though, right? Like, do you know what it was? It was very professional when I was in. Yeah. So, like, when I came into the squad, that was when Michael Checa came in.
He kind of came in
and he cracked the whip, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because Leinster was a little bit...
He seems like a madman.
Blowing in the winds in the first before I was there, do you know what I mean? So he kind of came in and he kind of transformed it into the kind of very professional setup. So, it was, from the rugby point of view, it was very professional. And then obviously Joe came in, took over from him, and kind of kept it going and kept driving standards and stuff. And then it was just kind of maybe tail end of Joe was when they started kind of nailing down on the stuff outside of rugby that you need to kind of.
And as for food there, then at club level, is it similar? Like, does Leinster have an area, or does everybody look after their own stuff? Like, or
we get some we get lunch lunches. So Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, we get a better lunch catered for us. Yeah.
Wow.
But other than that, breakfast up to you. Dinner's up to you.
Yeah. Dinner's up to you then yourself. Yeah. Whatever you have during the day.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
But that, I'd say some players would find that tricky, do they? I mean, obviously you've already said that you love food.
Mm-hmm.
You're surrounded by people.
Yeah.
That obviously made it easier for you.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like some lads hate cooking. Do you know what I mean?
I suppose the boys that aren't married or aren't parents yet or whatever. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. Like I'd say, there's a lot of eating out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I got a lot of Deliveroo.
I know Cian Healy's mad into his barbecue and that. Or I mean, he always seems to be anyway. Yeah. Like there's a few of the boys, Porter, Andrew as well.
Mm.
I think he was always keen on it. You just see it. I suppose we're fans. Like I know I certainly am. Like so, there's a lot of them you'd follow online and.
Mm.
And you see the interest is there in a
but
few
I think it's such a big part. Well, I've spoken to a good few sports people now. It's such a big part of their week. And I remember someone saying to me, it was the one part of their week that they really looked forward to, like getting to eat well and when they were in a camp going up to something.
Yeah.
Like, oh, then when I'm bleeding not in the camp, then I have to do it for myself and it's not the same. So,
yeah.
I'd say that could be where there's a lot of passion comes from. Yeah, ingredients.
You used to love going into camp, obviously, especially when Morris was there, because you'd think, oh, what do they have today? What's the post weight snack he has? Yeah. People have been running up to the camp to go get them.
But it's such a leap that Ireland took, investing in that. But I suppose when you look at the money they were spending in between the Shelburne and Carton House, anyways,
absolutely.
It's probably cheaper to bring it. Get some chefs on salary and.
But he's there for all the Ireland, the seven squads.
That's
all the,
right.
women, the women's squads, all the women's and the under 20s, and all the teams that use the performance centre he caters for.
It's magic. So then post rugby, then you say you're in the financial service industry now. How have you adapted to, I suppose, a normal job? You didn't give yourself any time at all to. Is that Mary cracking the whip going, get out of the house? Or
that's just general
just
life.
Just yourself, yeah.
General life
you're
cracking the whip.
You need to work.
You need to pay the mortgage and stuff. I retired in the June, had a good family holiday, took the summer off and then started in September. So I work with Paul Merriman. If you're on Instagram, you know him as Paul.
He's in my Lonely Hearts Man United WhatsApp group, yes.
Broken Heart.
Call it the Broken Heart group. Yeah. So I know Paul through that. He's another sad Man United fan like myself.
So started with him in the September after I hung up the boots, and kind of loved getting back into a routine. It's great being knowing that you have Monday to Friday 9 to 5, but I can kind of look after my own schedule. I can come and go as I please, but I can obviously set up meetings or set up calls around what needs to be done, and then it's just great having weekends back.
And it's not rugby, then you're not
I'm not doing anything really. The most I'm doing is bringing my young 6-year old to Lansdowne on a Sunday morning, pretty much for under sixes. No, that's my club. Well, it's his club now. So I went and played with Lansdowne after I left Castleknock. When you're in the academy, you go play with a club, an AAL club.
Right.
So Lansdowne.
You're not being roped for training yet or anything?
No, not yet.
How could you leave him sitting there?
But it's the thing, if you're roped with a coach, it's Tuesday nights, it's Thursday nights, and then it's going to a game on a Saturday or Sunday. So
that's the one benefit of being a chef. I can always I know it's the lazy option. You know what I mean? But I always try to take the kids, if I'm at home in Ireland, it's take them to every training and every match. I never miss them, whatever, but I just can't commit to training them and being there at that level, I suppose. You know what
it's such, but I mean, any community led sport, it's so important for the community.
Yeah.
And the commitment that people put into it.
They listen to shit from loads of parents, a lot
absolutely.
Of them.
Absolutely.
Rugby have that better, do they? The sidelines a bit quieter than.
We haven't done any proper games yet. It's 6 years that they don't even know to pass the ball back yet. You know what I mean? So it's haven't really experienced it yet. But for the community wise, it's really important because we does Gaelic for Kilmacud as well now. Kilmacud are a fantastic
club.
They're class. But it's really good because load of kids from his class are there, so we get to meet all the parents, and it's really kind of getting into that community kind of sense.
Yeah. What age were you, Devin, when you knew you were standing out from the crowd, as far as talent was concerned?
Well, height-wise, you're probably
that probably came early enough.
Height-wise, I was always there, but probably in around my end of fifth year in Castleknock, I got selected for a Leinster Schools trial.
Okay.
And that was kind of big enough for a fifth year to get picked as well. And then sixth year, obviously got picked for Leinster Schools and Irish Schools. But when I was in fifth year, my old coach then, it was Mick Quinn, used to play rugby for Ireland, and he used to play for Lansdowne as well. He cornered me and was like, what club are you going to play for after you leave school? And at that stage, I hadn't even thought I was going to.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to play rugby after school, am I? So I kind of had to
think about it.
And then sixth year, the under 20 or schools and Irish schools kind of getting about, and I was like, okay, I kind of like this. Yeah, so kind of fifth year, sixth year is when I kind of knew that it was kind of.
What age does Leinster have? What age do they take in academy kids nowadays? Is it younger?
It's still the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did the restaurant thing come around? How did that come around as an opportunity?
It just came up.
Who knew?
I just got an email from my agency, and they said, are you interested in this? I was like, absolutely. I was doing nothing else.
How did you find going into the kitchen, and was that your first time in a professional environment?
Yeah, pretty much. I had a fair idea of how it worked, but. Yeah. But yeah, I loved it.
You were great though, because you were.
I kind of wanted to do more because
you were nailed on though with your menu and what you wanted to do. The only thing was like, you're like, I don't care what we do with the oyster, but we're using Carlingford oysters. I
mean, yeah.
Obviously, there's some connection. I forget now, but there must be a family connection.
My dad, my dad grew up in Carlingford. So I still have an auntie Rosie who lives there. My granny was there. We spent. We used to go up 3 or 4 times a year to Carlingford, so absolutely loved it. Yeah. So it was kind of the first thing we needed to do was use the oysters. Like.
And we're not allowed to influence the menu unless like the chef says, like, listen, what will I do with it? And I was like,
do a Rockefeller.
I might have a good Rockefeller recipe.
Yeah, because I said I want to do oysters, but obviously raw, everyone doesn't love raw. So we might be able to do a cooked one somehow. And he was like, I actually have a good Rockefeller one. So I was like, absolutely.
We're allowed then to sort of slip in a wee suggestion, and leave. No more, but that panzanella, I've used that in France Chateau many times because, to be honest with you, I learned so much doing the show as well, because there's dishes like I'm trying to think of the comedian that was on the same season you were on,
Deirdre O'Kane.
Deirdre, she's really into her food, right? And I just keep thinking tomatoes as well when I think of her. She had a like this dish from St. John's, didn't know the dish or couldn't figure it out, or she came up with a name, didn't know the cheese or didn't know whatever, but I kept Googling it on the day and I found a photograph of it, and then I was able to
put it together,
create the dish, and just went through it. But with Debs, we made this marinade for your sourdough croutons, and just this red onion balsamic solution, almost as a marinade for the bread. Jesus, man, just unbelievable. Yeah. You know, if you get the tomatoes right, I mean, we talk about ingredients all the time.
And the bread, if the bread is
just the textures. Like, you obviously toasted the croutons first to get them hard, and then you put the marinade them again. It's hard.
Yeah. You've got to backtrack it, and you've got to get the timing right you soak them enough that they're not mushy or whatever. And but that's.
And how did you find the buzz of service?
It was great.
Surprise you about it, or.
Well, it's kind of hard because when you're one of the guests, you have to go and look at the screens and then give like reactions to their reactions. And then you have to jump back and then you have to go over here and then go over there. So I actually would have probably liked to do a bit more.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Stay there and help a bit more, but you're always being called out to do something over here. Yeah.
So the only slight difference to a normal restaurant is obviously. Like, they pound in, we feed 60 people, but they throw every table at you. But they'll only keep Dev, like, so maybe 50% of that. And then Muggins has to take over on his own then. And then they'll go over, and then you start getting that first wave of the main course, and then you obviously wrap up. So you're not in the whole station the whole night.
How did you go about writing the menu? What was the process there? You obviously want to
Mary.
A bit of both, Mary, Mary came up with the dessert. But obviously they wanted to connect it to you somehow. So like I was like, okay, so it was two starters. I was like, I've Carlingford oysters, we're gonna do I wanted to do something with the bread to bring my own sourdough. So
it,
perfect. And then the main course
I did a seafood
linguine or seafood
or
a seafood extravaganza, I think it was called.
That's right.
Because I had a really nice one in Italy over the summer holidays. And then I did a duck breast.
You were really into that seafood extravaganza. I was thinking, Jesus, he's really sold wherever he was in Italy that day. I was like, going, Jesus, what went on that day, Dave? I remember
the seafood. It was this place in Sardinia that we went to. But and then there was another one was a duck main course because there's a running joke in our family that anytime my dad said duck, he'd duck his head. And then the dessert, I love anything to do with lemon, so it was like a lemon tart. And then the other dessert was the one that Mary came up with. It was one that she used to do a little bit in chapter one, so it was a layered one with kind of mousse and crumble and all sort of stuff.
A lemon tart from Marco Pierre White, huh?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen his recipe for? Right. Yeah, you probably made it.
Yeah, like, made loads.
I mean, the amount of lemon.
Yeah.
No, Louise did a great job with that.
Oh, Louise takes it really serious. Mm. Yeah, to the point. Well, look, we normally ask our guests. I see, unless you're hiding a cookbook in your pocket, you haven't brought one. So we've been thinking about this for a while, actually. And anybody that might have a suggestion, food@goloudnow.com, send them in. But producer Ed, or Ed Chef, as he likes to be called, on a Monday and a Wednesday, Ed Chef has suggested desert island dish. What would you? I suppose you could call it your last supper, really, Dev. If you were stuck on a desert,
or just
island,
something that you like,
what would you like to eat?
Is there one thing that you're like, it's a tough one.
What could you not live without?
There's one thing. Well, like, I could say pizza. I love pizza.
You put an oven out in your backyard and it must be into it.
If I was doing the whole hog, I'd go for, obviously, lasagna.
Oh, yeah.
Lasagna, coleslaw, garlic bread.
Coleslaw?
Absolutely.
Jesus, Dave just started a war. The mafia will be out.
Is that your answer for coleslaw lasagna?
No.
It's the only way to eat lasagna.
A nice crunchy salad, garlic bread, coleslaw, lasagna.
The Italians will be turning in their graves.
They can do it.
Hunting you down. Jesus, a lovely coleslaw with lasagna burning the mouth off. It's just deadly.
Years and years ago, I did, Jamie Oliver had a nice recipe. It was a duck lasagna. Class. So, and did the whole hog. It was doing the duck, and then you do your own pasta as well. You're doing the layer, and that was unbelievable.
Pricey lasagna, that.
Yeah.
That's a good one, actually, isn't it? Lasagna and coleslaw. Talk about the patties just ruined the classic.
Yeah, but if it wasn't that, it'd be a pizza. It'd be a nice,
You're into the Italian food with panzana salad.
I love a bit of it. You obviously make
your own dough whenever you're doing the pizza. Do you make a sourdough pizza base or just a...
No, just normal. Whatever. Just normal yeast, yeah.
A little yeast one, yeah. Mm. I've got a wee... I do the frying pan method because I haven't... got a Gosney yet. I mean, I've every gadget you could think on outside.
I have
my
a feeling
patio.
There's a Gosney coming your way.
But you know what? I have attachments for the Kamado Joe. I have a dome for the Ophir. You know, the teppanyaki plate, the open wood flame. I have a unit that sits over that, sitting in my garage, above my motorbike, untouched. Because I'm just like, no, I'm gonna make a pizza. The next, because the frying pan method is just
it works. Mm.
It's so amazing. I have it down to a fine art. And for anybody that doesn't know the frying pan method, right? Really quickly, I'll tell you just emulate the heat. Because what you got to do, a pizza oven goes up to the guts of 400 to 500 degrees, right? A regular oven, you're going to roast meat at about 180 degrees, but you get your pan on. Piping hot, and then you put your base on. Now this, you got to have all your bits ready. You got to have your sauce ready, the cheese ready, and whatever toppings is going on. You have your oven preheated, the grill on, and it's just a fine balance. It's almost like a pancake when you do it on your pad. Sometimes the first one you make a dog's bollocks off it because it maybe sticks, you know. So the key is I do a wee salt seasoning in the pan. Generally have it down, but if the first one sticks, don't worry. And you're basically just recreating the heat of a pizza oven over a frying pan being on gas at high temperature all the way, sauce it, cheese it, top it, and then just gently lift the base of it. When you start to see the base, you'll almost actually see, if it's a tomato-based dish, you'll see the sauce start to bubble. You know that you're getting there, and then into the grill, Parmesan over it and a little bit of seasoning and put it in your grill, and then that obviously cooks the top part of it, you know what I mean? But it's beautiful if you don't have a fancy Gosney like Dev. Well, listen, thanks a million for coming in, Dev. I know you're a busy man. I was annoying you to get you in here, but you're brilliant whenever you did the show and really into your food. I was mad to get you on this one, being a bit selfish, but I think you're a legend.
Not at all.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. And best of luck in your new career.
Thanks for having me, Les.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, cheers. Wonderful. All the best.
So, that part of the show where Ed Chef now is going to give us our culinary conundrums. And it's definitely sticking, by the way.
How delighted I am.
I love it.
That name has stuck. Anyway, here we go. So it is culinary conundrums. Dear Gary and Gareth, my name is... Oh, this is very good. Sorry, I've read this one before. My name is Lila Darcy. I am 11 and live in Nace. My mam loves your podcast, but I'm not allowed to listen because she says Gary says too many curse words for me. she said I'm allowed to ask you a question, so please no bad words so I can hear it.
I'll answer this one.
Yeah. I absolutely love baking, and my school are having a bake sale and competition next week. I wanted to make fruit scones, but think they might be a bit boring. Is there anything I can do to make my scones more exciting? Thank you, Lila.
Well, that's a lovely question now in from Lila. And she sounds like she has her heart set on scones. So if you are going down, if your heart is set on scones, it's about adding a couple of little things just to give them some flavour. So, you know, there'd be nothing stopping you doing a white chocolate and cranberry, you could do a, you know, you could put hundreds and thousands in there if you wanted to make them nice and colourful. So you could kind of make them rainbow-esque, I suppose, after they're baked. But I would just say that maybe, just maybe step into the realm of like a chocolate brownie, because it's something that in a bake-off, chocolate is always going to get you big points if you're trying to win it. So I just bring you into a world where we're going to get you to win. So that's what I'd be saying to you. A chocolate brownie. Again, I know I said it last week as well, but there's a brownie recipe on my Instagram that it's literally foolproof. It's actually a recipe from Michel Roux, who's a very famous chef over in the UK. And his recipe is, it's like a fondant recipe that I've used lots of times. Mm. And I've tweaked it
a little bit. With a brownie is real chocolate and not cocoa powder.
And not to overcook it. So with a brownie, the less you cook it, the gooier it's going to be.
Oh, is that it?
And then if you cook it on a little bit more, it starts getting into the realm of cake. So it depends on how you like it. If you like them nice and gooey, then you cook it, you let it cool, and you put it into the fridge, and then you cut it the next day, and it'll have like a fudge type texture. But if you like it that it's more cakey, then add another 15 or 20 minutes onto the cooking time of the recipe, and you'll have it that it's more like a chocolate cake rather than a fudge. But that's what I would say.
What was her question there, real quick again? Like,
she wants to cook scones. That's her go-to for this bake-off in school.
Yeah,
she wants to see how she can jazz it up.
Jazz them up.
Get herself ahead of the pack.
Okay. Well, look, if she wants to stick with scones, that's a great suggestion, with Gareth. Maybe to veer towards chocolate. It's always a way to the judge's heart, as the man says. You know, but. Scones take really well to sugar too, so sweetening them up, you know, like whenever you glaze them, put a wee bit of palm sugar or brown sugar on after you do a little egg wash on the top of it, sprinkle it with sugar and add a wee bit of sweetness to it, you know. I don't like raisins, you know, so goji berry, cranberry is another good suggestion. Our little goji berries are really, really nice. If you want to have something within them, do that. But probably the best way of jazzing it up is to keep the scone plain, do the little thing with the brown sugar on the top, and then play around with jams or compotes. Okay, so if you really want to go with scones, like, buy some clotted cream or do a little bit of clotted cream, which is what the Queen used to love, you know what I mean? The English and the Queen in particular, they love a wee bit of clotted cream on the side. It's a classical way of serving it with the scones. And then, you know, get a couple of different recipes, like, you know, for jams or compotes on the side. I've loads of different ones. Like, if you buy frozen berries and you buy jam sugar, once you bring jam sugar to the boil for a certain amount of time, cook it for about 40-45 minutes, it'll nearly always set. And when you buy the jam sugars, there's a perfect little recipe on the back of the packet. So whether you buy frozen mango chunks or you buy frozen mixed berries or blueberries or whatever it may be, you can turn them all into different
generally one-to-one.
Yeah, you can turn them all into you can turn them all into jams. So that's what I would do. Pick two or three different color fruits, frozen fruits, make one or two little fancy funky condiments, also have your clotted cream, and then just make, if you Google Paul Hollywood and scones, right, he likes to use strong flour. It's a 500 gram mixture. I would give it to you all, but I can't exactly remember it all. Right, here's the other thing when it comes to scones as well: make them thicker than what you buy. So whenever you roll out the scone, make sure that it's quite thick, and then cut it. So have it nearly the size of the scones that you see in the shop, and then cut them, and they'll rise really, really big. They'll stand out from the crowd if it's a super big scone. They'll look bigger than all the little miserable friends and what they've done on the table. You'll have these gorgeous big scones and then your fancy little condiments, and I promise to stop cursing.
He's going to break that promise, just so you know.
Yeah, I'm so... Lila, listen, best of luck with the bake-off next
Let us know how you get on.
Do, yeah. Hi, lads. James here in Galway. I originally read that as James Galway, but it's not. It's James in Galway. Big fan of the podcast. I'm a trainee chef myself, and you two are massive heroes of mine. I have something I'm struggling with my cooking, and it's my time management. I can tend to overanalyze and get too focused on one issue to the detriment of anything else that needs my attention. Is there any time management tips you can pass on? Cheers, James.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer in looking at a clock. Every kitchen I'm ever in, you must have a clock, not a digital clock, an analog clock. You have to have an analog clock in the kitchen, right? I have this rule of thumb. First and foremost, in particular, with younger cooks, you know, let's just presume that you're competent at whatever it is that you're doing, but maybe you're just not doing it quick enough, right? And a little trick that I've often, you're not really teaching the boys, but I would look at a task that I would give to some chefs in my kitchen. I would probably add on a few minutes, maybe for their levels or where I know that they're at, because they're maybe my staff or whatever. And I would say, right, boys, it's 2 o'clock now, at 20 past two, the big hands at the four, this dish is done. That's it. I said, take everything else out of your focus. If your phone bleeps or messages come in, absolutely. If you're still doing that dish beyond 20 past the hour, you're not focused. And it is amazing once you dial everybody into the time. In the back of their mind now, they know that the boss is watching them, not hounding over them, but you're just like going, listen, if you in a professional environment where time is money, and let's just be honest about it, time is of the essence, time is money. If you're not productive, I've seen many a brilliant chef. I know lots of really, really brilliant cooks and brilliant chefs that are so slow. They've never, ever applied speed. And speed is secondary to quality. But there does come a time when you're more senior that you've got to do things in a timely manner. This is something that's really serious. It's something actually I take really serious at work and in a professional environment, because you cannot have somebody lagging behind in productivity. And you can teach yourself this. Pick a time, be reasonable, and just say, I will have it done by then. And you'd be amazed whenever you stop jumping on Twitter or jumping on Facebook or going outside for a cigarette or popping to the toilet or talking nonsense to somebody. When you dial in the time, you will get it done and it'll become second nature.
Yeah, I mean, everything that Gary has said there, but a technique that you actually learn it when you go into college first. And I know a lot of people think they don't learn when they're in college, but you do, and it's like a work schedule. So if you are really struggling that you find that things aren't just going the way they should be, you just do your prep list or your mise en place list, as we call it, and you just put little numbers beside it, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 5 minute break, 20 minutes.
It's like a running order for a radio show or a podcast.
Exactly, and you know, I think most cooks will have a little black book on their section where they keep their recipes and they keep their bits and pieces. So you just start getting used to just putting timings around everything. On the sauce section that I spoke about last week, most sauce chefs will have 4 or 5 little clocks that come with magnets on them, and you just set timers on them. So when you put a steak into the oven, you put it on for 6 minutes, and then as you get more experienced and as time goes on, using a clock to kind of to manage how things are happening around you will become second nature. So unfortunately, it's just, you'll have to give it a bit of time. Because it's just
boom, boom.
Yeah, exactly. Here all week. It comes with time, and you just get better at it as time goes on. But don't get disheartened. That's a very common challenge that most people happen in cookery.
And good luck with that, James. Final conundrum. Hello, Gareth and Gary. I foolishly told my wife I'd cook her any dinner she wishes for our anniversary next week, and she's only gone and told me she wants oysters. I've never cooked them before, and I don't know where to begin. I was wondering if you have any tips and also some advice on what ones to get from where and what to serve them with. Panicked in Bray. Hasn't given his name, rather wisely.
I suppose the first challenge you're going to run into is how you open it. So just make sure whenever you go and buy your oysters, and if you're out in Bray, you're going to go to, I don't know whether there's a fishmongers out there, but you know, you'll have to go to the fishmongers.
There'll be one in Greystones anyway. There's somebody out there, yeah.
You'll have to get yourself a little oyster knife. So that's, you know, that, and it's definitely a must. You have to get yourself, it's a short little blade with a point on it.
With a guard as well.
There's a guard on it, exactly. And then, you know, just make sure that, you know, there's loads of YouTube tutorials how to open an oyster, but you just wrap a cloth around your hand, you put the oyster in it, you go up to one side of the oyster, you just feed the knife in to the top of the muscle, and you just twist the knife, it pops the lid off. At that point, what you're going to do is the shell is curved, at the back of that there's another little muscle that holds the oyster on, and you just nick that, and then you've got your oyster away from the shell. I would say, if you're new to the world of cooking oysters, I would go down the road of a tempura. So just make a very light tempura about it. There's loads of recipes on there. But I like to use sparkling water that's nice and cold, 50-50 flour and corn flour and some seasoning. And then you put a little wok on, or if you've got a fat fryer, even better. You just put your oyster into some flour, into your tempura and then deep fry it. And make, Gary gave out a recipe there for a pineapple salsa, which would be wonderful. Or just a very simple sweet chili and lime vinaigrette. Or just keep it nice and simple. I mean, if I'm eating oysters, there's nothing wrong with just a little bit of Tabasco and a squeeze of a lemon. If she likes oysters, then I wonder why she wants you to cook oysters for her on the night. Let's just have a think about that
one. Think about
that.
We'll do that for the late night dish.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's a tricky one. But again, look, if your partner is a fan of oysters, you might get away with the old mignonette, like just the red onion and a little dice of red onion and a little bit of vinegar, Tabasco and lemon, as Gareth says. But if it's a first time chancing at it, then you got to cook them, you know, like there's no two ways about it. But look, there's a million different ways, you know, for something that a lot of people you would think don't really eat. I don't know, I find myself chatting about oysters an awful lot on this program, but definitely the hot way. I like a little bit of Savoy cabbage or York leaf or whatever cabbage you can get your hands on at this time of year, sliced up really fine and sauteed with a little bit of oil, finished with butter and bacon as well. So diced bacon and cabbage. I do one with bacon and cabbage and a Guinness Sabayon, but that's, you don't need to add the Guinness Sabayon. It's basically just egg yolks and the head of a pint of Guinness, and you whip the egg yolks with a little bit of seasoning until they're thick, creamy, double in bulk, and that's known as a Sabayon. And then you fold in the head of a pint of Guinness, spoon that froth over the bacon and cabbage stuffed oyster, and you blowtorch that, and you sort of crack through the head of that. It's a really nice way. It's going to be on my menu in Paris next month, and that's a nice way and a wee bit of an Irish way of stuffing the oysters and cooking them. And outside of that, best of luck, brother. Once you start,
in every,
it's true what they say. You start scoffing oysters.
In every sense,
best wear clean pants.
Thanks everyone for your conundrums. Keep them coming in on food@goaloudnow.com.
So, Big Dev, great guest, wasn't he?
Absolutely brilliant and so much knowledge, and I didn't realise he was so into cooking.
Yeah.
Although someone had told me about his experience on the restaurant, so he got five stars.
Yeah. He was brilliant on the day too, you know, like, because look, he, between his family, all of them, you know, obviously Mary, his wife, like, she's really into it. A lot of those boys out of the Irish rugby team are food mad. I mean, you see Cian Healy and the likes of them steady barbecuing and cooking up a storm, and they're all mad into it. But Dev, you know, I have vivid memories of that day. Look, as we spoke about there, you know, like, there was a few dishes on that. I mean, I might have kind of give a wee bit of a recipe on the oysters Rockefeller, but he was hell bent, obviously, because of his connections to Carlingford, that he wanted to do them. You know what I mean?
And I think the rugby players, because they have to get so many calories in, I think food is just a big part of what they do. So
yeah,
you can understand why some of them,
he can eat whatever he wants. You know?
Because he's such a big boy.
Yeah, yeah, he's a unit, isn't he?
Okay, well, look, that's another brilliant show this week and another brilliant guest. So thanks.
Are we allowed to say that? Are we allowed to say it? I say that to Annette all the time. I come in after listening to it, say, Jesus, me and Gaz are going all the way to the top. I goes, that's the best podcast I ever listened to. Just rolls her eyes at me. She thinks I'm such a loser, you know.
I meant the guest was brilliant. Well, all right, let's go down that road.
I thought you were chatting with me.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.